House of Grace, dein Podcast zu Hause für die großen und kleinen Fragen und Antworten des Lebens mit Sandra von Sapienski.
Dear Dharma, thank you for taking again your time to talk to me.
Sure.
And I do have some like urgent questions because as you know, I told you because you're my teacher and we are in continuous contact, and thank you by the way for all the support you are giving to me.
Sure.
I had such a difficult time the last weeks or the last month. I was struggling on so many areas, and I really was also struggling with my practice, because the practice you gave me, I just couldn't do it, because it also, and there's also a prayer for awakening involved. Mm-hmm. And to be very honest, I was in a state where I was so devastated, and I thought, if there's also awakening coming, I can't handle it. So this was also the start for me to reflect and contemplate about awakening. And the assumption behind the thought that I can't handle awakening in this situation right now is that I think that awakening isn't per se a positive, happy, shiny thing, but can also be like really hard or painful. And I was just, I didn't feel like being able to handle it. And I thought you might could shed some light about the Trigamasida yoga view on awakening, and if this was intuitively a good decision I made.
Okay, sure. So awakening is very popular today to talk about awakening, especially in Shaivist influenced tantric yoga circles, Facebook groups, workshops, and it's constant. And you have, even now, it's penetrated the normal world, at least in the Western, I think, and maybe in Europe too, about being woke. Is that also in Europe? Well, people will talk about being woke. I'm woke. Are you woke? You know?
Not so much in Europe.
Okay.
But as I do have a lot of contacts to the American.
You see it. Yeah.
I'm familiar with that.
Right, right.
We have also other questions regarding that, but one after the other.
So what is this awakening thing, and what is the importance of it? Why do we have it positioned as the very first prayer in the foundation practice and so on? So let's talk about that. So it is, I think, a mature decision. It shows a level of maturity and a level of clarity about your actual situation, that you chose to say, I can't handle an awakening right now with all this stuff going on in my life. So I don't see that as a total negative at all. Okay.
I'm still relieved that you say that.
Yeah. I don't want you to stay there, but it's a good thing for now. You're clear about it, because awakenings of any nature below stage 7, those awakenings will bring a sense of pain first. Mm-hmm. Any awakening, so we have 12 stages of full enlightenment, right? We're going to get into that later, what is enlightenment and so on. So we have 12 stages of full enlightenment. But stage 7 is a very, very high stage where you can recognize that the person is very full of wisdom, very much abiding in their true nature, all those definitions, you know. Mm-hmm. And the awakenings that occur to bring one to stage 7 have to be accompanied with practices. The awakenings are just moments. They really mean nothing unless you practice afterwards in the state of the awakening. That's the important thing. I want you to remember this. Put it on the inside of your eyelids with a tattoo. Awakening means nothing. We have to practice in the state of the awakening that we just had for it to become something real. The second thing I would add to this is that if the awakening is not contextualized within a Dharma tradition that has a full path laid out to full realization, if in other words, you're with a teacher who made up their own system or something, then the awakening has no place to fall into a proper context. And then when you try to practice in the state of that awakening, you could just be taking yourself further down a distracted path, you know, a heretical path away from real realization, true realization. So awakening always before stage 7 is accompanied by pain. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we are seeing basically our limited situation we're seeing our suffering clearly that we don't really embrace fully. Even we can be complaining about our situation, but if we have an awakening at that moment, it's going to really show us our situation. So pain is normal there. In fact, the cycle of growth in real spiritual work always goes some type of realization, some discovery about oneself, one's nature, you know, or the situation you're in, whatever. There's some discovery, some realization, followed by intense pain. And then that's followed by, sometimes actually the revelation can be immediately hit with an exaltation, a happiness, a joy can be prevailed. Oh my God, oh wow, I didn't know. But if it's authentic realization and awakening, and you're not in stage 7 yet, you're in 1 through 6, when that realization hits, right after the joy, boom, or directly, it's going to be painful, intensely painful, because it's showing you clearly how far you are from the real path still, how far you are from knowing your true nature, how much negative karma you're still producing in your own life or causing for others, and so on and so on. So there has to be pain there. And, you know, you feel separated from your own essence. That's painful. And you know now how separated you are. When we're distracted by normal daily things, even our spiritual work can distract us, we don't really feel that separation so strongly. One of the characteristics of awakening is because it's an essence experience, it puts us into that essence experience and we realize just how far we are from it.
So can I just say something?
Please.
You are describing my last weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was exactly like that. I mean, it was so painful. And, you know, when we talked and I was like, no, you are not right. I mean, I said it in more nice words. And later I was like, oh, okay. In some points he is right. And I can see where I could see, I mean, the last week showed me so how deeply rooted some patterns are, and one pattern and one belief sentence I incorporated in my life, I could dissolve it. And that didn't lead to happiness, but to a kind of deep relief and like grounding. And that's the part I'm thankful for the last weeks. But is it, what was that a kind of, I don't want to say that it was an awakening, but is it like something similar?
Oh, I don't know. Only you can say. It's your experience. But
I felt very separated and I felt very far away from the path.
I see. I think it was good that we wake up and see that we have these limitations and that we haven't overcome them yet. I think that's a very positive thing. And that's 1 through 7. If that's not part of the so-called awakening experience of 1 through 6, then stages 1 through 6, then I don't think it's real, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Now, what we do with it after that is what it all comes down to. That's what matters. I don't think, you know, to just speak of what you just said about failing, I don't think it's at all bad to say we fail. New Age people would say, never say you fail. Everything, a mistake is a learning process. Whatever. We fail. We fall face down in the dirt terribly. We fail. We screw up. We majorly F up. Yes, we do, on the path and in life. And saying we fail is, I think, extremely important, because without that, how do we correct? Mm. How do we truly embrace what we need to do if we say, well, it's all nice and it's okay and it's in the game of learning and Shiva doesn't matter, doesn't care, and God forgives me, you know, whatever. Silliness. So awakenings like this are important, and it can be grounding because you get where you're really at. But here's the thing. Depending on where you're at in your path, this type of awakening where you fall on your face, which is a good one, will either inspire you to go deeper, stronger, or make you go, oh God, it's just too much. Can I have another champagne and a new boyfriend, please? You know, so we have to decide what it is that we really want. And sometimes, like in the old tradition of Shaktipata from Kashmir, really, really old tradition, they would say that if the Shaktipata that you've had that got you on the path was too weak, very weak, then you will not be inspired by these things that happen. You'll feel defeated and you won't get back on the horse, you know, back on the bicycle. Like when you're a kid, you fall off the bike a lot but you want to ride because your friends are all riding, you know? So you get back on, even though it hurts like hell and you're bleeding from your elbows and your knees, scrape them, you know? So if you had enough Shaktipata, then you say, oh yeah, man, I'm getting back on that bike because I want to be with everybody else. I want to be in my true nature. I want to understand what realization is. You know, there's a burning desire and it puts you back on the bike. So yes, it's grounding in one way, but in another way, you know, it's grounding, yes. And it's either grounding you towards, I don't want this spiritual stuff, man. I'm going to turn off that. I'm going to close that door. Or I'm getting back on the bike. Let's go. I'm so grateful it showed me where I'm really at. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing.
Yeah. I feel both. Like I'm totally up for the new boyfriend and the champagne, but also for getting back on the bike.
That's okay. That's fine. That just shows where we're at. So as long as you're getting back on the bike, that's what matters. Sooner or later, champagne and boys gets a bit old.
But I don't mind when awakening kicks in as well. So, good. And good. I also found back to my practice, and the practice was also super important during this time. I just had to change it. And I can't imagine how I would have gone through this difficult times, especially with this train thoughts I had, and I cried so much. And at the same time, I could say, not always, but very often, that I could tell that it's not me, you know, it's not only me. So practice was super helpful. I think also, when we talk about realization, enlightenment, awakening, everyone in the spiritual scene is using these terms. And sometimes I don't know what people understand, or it's like trendy words. You know what I mean? And
right.
Sometimes I have the feeling there is no meaning behind, because that's also why I talked a lot with my friend Anna, who you know as well, about awakening and realization and what our interpretation of these words mean for us personally, what we think it is. And I think it could be super helpful if you could explain us or define or give us one definition of these terms.
Yeah, sure. Let's make it really simple for all the listeners. This is real. I'm really happy you asked this, because this is where a major amount of confusion occurs. Mm-hmm. Why people get duped by cult leaders, why people get confused in their own practice and don't get results, you know, so on and so on. Why they pick systems that are ineffective, that don't have these kind of teachings, you know, which is most of them out there in this new age market now, neo tantra, whatever. So let's talk about it. So, in our tradition, the tradition speaks about 12 stages of realization. Stage one, we're ignorant of anything spiritual. And we're going about our lives either as a good person or a bad person, but we're completely ignorant. You could say unawake. Mm-hmm. And then all the 11 stages after, from stage 2 to 12, are stages of awakening. So this is why, you know, when someone talks about, I had an awakening, in the Hindu, Shaivist, Neo-Tantra, New Age, whatever world out there right now of all these people who are self-proclaimed gurus, self-authorized gurus, not teaching full systems, philosopher turned guru, whatever. They don't understand that there are levels and levels of awakenings. And to be excited about any awakening as if you think you've had the final realization is really foolish. Or to think that you've touched your deepest, deepest essence, the aspect of you that never changes. There's only one aspect of you and only one aspect of this universe that never changes. And we, in our tradition, we call it the base. So that base experience, do you think your awakening came from the base? Well, if it did, that's quite a high awakening, right? Or was it from one of the layers of awarenesses that exist as the base projects into this world? We have like awareness, thought awareness kind of levels, not the base itself. So people don't even know these distinctions. They haven't even been taken through the practices to tease apart these distinctions and know what their awakening is. So they don't know how to value it correctly, how to contextualize it, what the meaning of it is. Now, so when I talk about enlightenment in our tradition, every time you hear our tradition talk about enlightenment or realization, we're talking about full stage 12 realization. So let's call that full realization or full enlightenment for our discussion here. But usually if I'm just using the term enlightenment or realization off the cuff like that in a conversation, I mean full realization or full enlightenment, meaning stage 12 rainbow light body. So the full realization is when we become a Buddha, a realized, in Sanskrit, a Buddha means one who is awakened. Mm-hmm. Funny, we're using this term awakening. So now you can see what Sanskrit means. Hear how the ancient tradition saw awakening. They used a term for the awakened one, for one who was completely awakened beyond any kind of other awakening, right? Any temporal awakening based on thought awareness. And that person's called a Buddha. Doesn't matter what tradition you come from. This is not a Buddhist term. This is a Sanskrit term from ancient India that every tradition uses for an awakened being. So enlightenment then for us in our tradition is that we realized if you're still sitting in a human body, even though you could be in stage 7, which is very realized, or 8 even more, 9 even more, 10 even more, 11, let's say. But if you're still in a human body, you're still not a full Buddha. You still have more to go on the human path of realization. So optimizing or experiencing the full what it is to be human is when, while we're alive, or just after we die in the after-death state, we can do it two ways. We resolve any last clinging to our own personal story and the five elements that were held together by our clinging to our own personal story that kept taking incarnation over and over again. As you know, it's our story that incarnates over and over again, not really anything else. That story comes apart and it can no longer hold together the five elements. The five elements come apart and we experience what ancient masters called the rainbow body. A light body, Prakashakaya, wisdom light body, rainbow body, Jadlu in Tibetan. So as the five elements leave the constriction of our ego structure and return to their home, let's say, in poetic terms, a display of light is seen, physical display of light is seen by people in the area who are observing, right? So, but this light is five elemental light. It's different than physical light, very different. It's a spiritual experience, actually.
Can I ask something regarding the light? But it doesn't mean that you die, right?
If you're alive while you do the rainbow light process, you have not died and you will never die. And you've realized a state where you were never even born. So we say that the light body realization resolves both birth and death, death and birth, not just death. So instead of people always think about, oh, I don't have to die, I'll be immortal. That's a little bit of the beginning idea. But really, rainbow light body means you don't die, but you also were never born. You went so beyond time that you realized time was just this dream fabric, and you were never really a part of it.
But you can still be there in this world and teach and have students.
No, not as a rainbow light body. When you're a rainbow light body, you're gone. Mm-hmm. There's no individual in stage 11.
And this is the final final enlightenment.
Yes, this is the final, this is full realization, full enlightenment, right? So this is one of the reasons I really detest when people with self-made tradition walk around saying they're realized and tell you all about their realization moment and put videos out on it. I'm like, who cares? Because, you know, you're just a human being walking around still making mistakes. You had some moment, now you teach, la, 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 who cares? You're kind of an aware person. You act like a robot. You talk like a robot. Who cares? What I'm interested in is the full path. And when people grasp onto their realization moment and make like they're realized and talk about how enlightened they are, they actually commit the major error of recreating a spiritual story about themselves instead of the real goal, which is releasing all stories, right? And this is the problem, right?
So
that's full realization. Then let me just say from stage 7 to 11, are the partial enlightenment stages, partial realization, partial enlightenment, stages 7 to 11, and stages 2 to 6 are the path to have your first stabilized realization of your true base, your essence, which happens at 7. Okay, now I've laid it out.
I'm still clinging to this, to the fact that when you are in rainbow light body, you dissolve, you die.
You don't die.
Your life, your body, your flesh body
dissolves. No, it didn't die.
But we do practice to let our flesh body die. I always thought that.
What does that mean? Practice letter flesh by
Yeah, I'm so sorry because I'm not a native. Sometimes I think
that's okay.
I'm so good at expressing my thoughts.
No, you're good.
So my thought behind is I thought that it would be possible to be enlightened, and they were enlightened teachers and gurus who had disciples and students. But if I understand it right, the final enlightenment is when you leave your flesh body. And so this is a practice where you prepare yourself to die, or this is the goal, to leave this body.
Okay. So
do you now we talk. What I mean?
Mm-hmm. So what I described before is the fruit, right? The fruit of the path is full realization or partial realization from stages 7 to 11, full realization at 12. This is the fruit of the path. Now you're talking about, okay, so some people walk around and they seem to be realized and teaching. What is it about? So let's talk about that first. So it's very simple, really. When the Buddhas become fully realized as Buddhas and they spontaneously are manifesting the base experience as their body, as what they, you know, quote unquote body. It's not a physical body. It's their experience. That's why we call a body is the experience. So when the fully realized beings are manifesting their base body, you know, which is called Dharmakaya in the traditions usually, in Shaivism it's called Shiva Bindu, then out of that base body, spontaneous energy arises of compassion and wisdom. And it arises in the form that has the only purpose to help beings become realized. And then that is what flows into this very limited dimension as the Dharma teachings, as the transmissions, as the whole Dharma systems and paths that understand the 12 stages and the rainbow light body, etc. And a part of that flow is then part of that extension of a Buddha's body are people who are teaching. In other words, Sandra, you have me on a podcast here. I'm not thinking that I'm a person sitting in this house in Costa Rica talking to you about spirituality and you're in Germany. I'm experiencing that I'm an emanation. I am an emanation of a great Buddha, I'm part of that body, mm-hmm. right? And I'm sitting here as part of the body of a great Buddha at a much lower level. And I'm an authorized teacher of this kind of tradition of awakening or realization in this flow down into this dimension. But I'm not in stage 12, not 11, not 10, this kind of thing. I'm much lower, right? Mm-hmm. So realized beings that we talk about who are teachers, we have to remember from our definition, are always partially realized, but they're essential to this dimension, essential to our development, and they come from fully elaborated systems of Dharma that bring you to the fruit at the very end. They're not made up by somebody. They're not a commercial marketing venture, you know, mm-hmm. because it extends down from that awakened Buddha. In other words, again, how I see myself placed here, which helps dissolve any sense of having my own ego structure running the show or having it about me or anything, is that I'm purely an extension of a Buddha. I'm purely doing what's needed. As students say, I need teachings. Can you help me? I just respond. So in that way, we're all playing this role from the parampara, which is the expression, the waterfall of essence coming down into this dimension, you see. So then people can be realized partially at stage 7 and be a great teacher, 8, 9, like that, even 10, although 10 is rare to find a person teaching at stage 10. Usually they're out of public sight. So 7, 8, 9 is where you find your great teachers today that we would usually call enlightened or realized. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're not going to harm anyone. They're not going to harm anyone. They know the complete path. They have complete humility. They know where they are in the path. They still practice. They had gurus or lamas or daosha. They had a tradition. They're in a lineage. They have a fully elaborated tradition that has produced many enlightened beings the same way before. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are the people that we can trust as teachers, that we should have as teachers, you know? And that's why, to some degree, the authorization process is still important, I believe, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I'll give you an example. There's a person I know, no names here, no need to run anybody down, just an example. And I want to give a real example. I don't want to make it up. There's a person I know who had sent me emails saying, I don't understand this text. I really don't understand this text. This text confuses me. The last blah, blah, blah passages are very confusing. Could you please help me understand them? And I said, sure. So I taught I explained as best I could what I knew about the experience of these passages in this text. And the person was very excited and very happy about this, right? Mm-hmm. So then later you see the person begins to become popular and has to kind of fabricate the truth about how they learned about what that text means. In other words, they didn't have a guru. They didn't have real training with the guru. And I, you know, it's sad to me to see this, because here I have the emails from the person saying, oh yeah, I had very little contact with any teachers about this, and I don't know about it, and would you please explain it to me? So if this person had a guru who explained this to them, if they came from a tradition that was alive, that had this fully laid out tradition of 12 stages and so forth, the teacher would explain to them these passages very simply, just like I did. Mm-hmm. But then you see people have, you know, other motives for wanting to be seen as a teacher, or making money, or avoiding hard work, whatever it is, you know. Maybe want to be seen as someone powerful or realized, ego, fame, I don't know. But whatever. Then they make up a story about how they learned about these passages from this book, you see. And this is why I think sometimes it's important that we look at, did the person train with somebody real? This is important. Do they have a verifiable training? Now, some people who trained with people can also come out bad. They can make bad decisions, do bad things, right? Mm-hmm. But if we have a person who's, steeped, marinated in stage 7 and above, they will never harm students. They will never lie to students. They will never use them for their own benefit and so forth. They will never fake their history. They will never have to make up a fake history because they're in stage 7 because of the grace of their teacher in the first place. That's how they got there, you see? Mm-hmm. Maybe we went off track a little bit.
Maybe.
What did you want to get to? What did you want to say? Bring it back.
Actually, you answered a question I had, because there are some teachers out there who are saying they are enlightened, or they talk only about their awakening. And yeah. I always feel like that I have to distract myself from that, because I don't understand how you can make a whole business model out of your awakening process. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Exactly.
It just felt very strange and like awkward and
yeah.
And well, just not right to me.
Can I say something about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
So why would someone need to talk about their awakening experience or how they think they're fully realized? Why would they have to? Why would they do that? We have to think as a consumer, as a spiritual consumer, as a student, we have to think, why would I have to think about, why would I, as a teacher, why would I talk about that? Mm. What would be the utility of that? Here, I'll tell you why. Because when you're talking about an experience that is like a stage 7, 8, 9 experience, anybody from stage 1 to 5, they don't even know what you're talking about. They might, in stage 5, they might study the teachings and be doing practices in stage 5 strongly. So then they're like, oh, I think I have a hint of what this is about. I think I might know what the person's talking about. Like, just, I might know about it, but I haven't experienced it. So why would there be any utility in that at all? So I had Shaiva gurus and I had Dzogchen gurus, and none of them in my entire history of studying with them, which spans 35 years of studying with them, still I'm studying, of course, you never stop studying, still I'm studying, training with them. None of them ever at one point described their enlightenment experience. Nor did any of them ever say, I'm fully realized, or I'm realized, or I'm enlightened. Never, not one, never. And this is men and women, you know, that I trained with. And so I find it to be a big red flag when people start talking about it. Because first, we know from, here's what I'm saying, from a real Dharma tradition, nobody talks about it. If you're really deeply in your tradition, like Shaivism, Trika Shaivism, the scriptural Shaivism from Kashmir, that's pretty much a broken tradition. So I don't even count anything from that. The Tantric Yoga, the Shaivist Tantric Yoga I came from, that's a solid tradition still going, and no one talked about it there. In the Bumpa Dzogchen, nobody talked about it there. My Taoist masters, no one talked about it there. No one would talk about their own experience, because the Dharma traditions themselves when you become a teacher, they make it very clear. This is not something you talk about for a few reasons. Well, some people say, oh, it's so private. No, not only just because it's so private, it's because you can't put into words what that experience is. And every time you put it into words, you're conceptualizing it. So the teacher makes the grave error of conceptualizing their own experience, which is supposed to be outside of conception. Now you're communicating it to students and an audience, and they're hearing it, and they think, this is how it should be. So they start to meditate thinking, this is how I should have my experience. Mm-hmm. Now they've made a grave error too, but the teacher caused it. They've put an object out as a goal out in the middle of their path, and it was just the teacher's explanation of what they experienced. So in real Dharma tradition, here's the first thing I want to say, Sandra, no one talks about it. In fact, we're told never to talk about your own experience of enlightenment or realization, because if you have any wisdom at all, you'll know that it can't be spoken of. And as soon as you do, it changes it. And as soon as someone hears it, it ruins their path.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So this is very important why no one talks about it. But yet, you know, I have to be honest with you. I'm not going to name names because we have vows against calling people out. Well, actually, we have vows against talking about other traditions that are actually valid Dharma traditions but are not our own sect, our own tradition, right? Let's say I'm practicing Bumpo Dzogchen. Then I shouldn't talk about Kagyu or Gelugpas, the other Tibetan Buddhists, or about Sikhs or something, because these are real traditions, you know. We may have different idea of what the fruit is, but they're real traditions, so we're not about to talk about that. But actually, in the ancient tradition, it was no problem to talk about fakers, charlatans, inauthentic, self-authorized gurus, lamas, and call them out by name. In fact, in our tradition that I came from first, my Shaiva yoga tradition, if someone was caught being fake like that, or doing something wrong, they would pull their earrings out. These big conch shell earrings that were in the tragus, the cartilage of the ear, not put in the little lobe of the ear. It was right in the middle of the ear, the thickest part. They would pull them straight out of their head so that the ear would rip in half, so that everybody who ever saw them in that culture of North India and Nepal knew, oh, you're a faker. Stay away from you, you know. But nowadays, oh my God, if you were to call somebody out, if you were to say this teacher's a faker, you are ridiculed as not letting everybody have their experience. You know, there's this whole kind of new agey, postmodernistic philosophy nowadays says everybody's entitled to have their own experience no matter what. That's not the truth in the Dharma tradition, because that can hurt people. That can mislead people. And in the old days, people did call each other out and people would challenge them to a duel, a Dharma duel. So they would go and have a debate. And if you lost that debate, if it was clear that you didn't know what the hell you were talking about and the other person did, you and all your students had to join the other person's school. Right? And that's, I really wish it was that time again. I really wish, because I see debates and I hear people doing debates now, but you're not allowed to take it to the mat, as we say in wrestling. You know, you're not allowed to take them all the way down and make them cry uncle. Okay, I quit. You got me. You know, you have to be nice to a certain degree. And then the thing is, people fake things, so you can't really debate anymore. No one's being honest. Debating in the old days was honest. We had honest people who thought they had an experience. They would meet, and then it would become clear that even though you thought you were having a high level of spiritual experience, this teacher just put you in your place and showed you that you didn't know what the hell you were talking about. And you were so grateful that you became their student. And your students were so grateful that your teacher had so much humility to try to find the truth that the students joined the teacher in being a student of the other teacher. Now that is beautiful. That is the way it should be. And I'm open to those kind of debates anytime, any place, but you just don't see it anymore.
Yeah, I can't remember a debate like that.
No. And then, so like I've heard, you know, just so I'm going to say here, I'm not going to name a name, right? But I've watched three videos where people, major teachers in the world today, major modern teachers, not lamas, not real traditional gurus from India who are Indian. Oh, actually, one of them is. One of them is one from one of so-called some kind of tradition. I don't know what it is, but he's Indian and he says he comes from a tradition of yogis. But two other people are Westerners and they all have videos. And these videos are long, Sandra. And these videos, this person one time spent like 45 minutes in this video describing his enlightenment experience, mm-hmm. why he's enlightened. And I'm thinking, that's a huge red flag, because I told you our tradition says you don't talk about it. And as I watched him talk about it, I saw how he was completely invested in the idea. And I thought, okay, this is one of the big red flags now for today. Don't go to people who talk about realization or their own realization.
Okay, I think it's a good note for everyone. How would you? I think it's super interesting to get to know a bit about your personal process. Would you say you are? I mean, I know you are not allowed to talk about it, but maybe you can say how your life has changed from when you were in stage one and wherever you are right now.
There's some things, sure, we can talk a bit about biography. We just can't, you know, get egotistical and prideful about
dog
attainment.
Is so loud right now. Do you hear him?
What is? No, I hear nothing.
Dog? Okay.
No, thank goodness. First, we have to understand from the teachings say that, and my experience of human beings is that we enter the world, not everybody at stage one. Or I could say not everybody with a lot of karma left at stage one. Some people enter at stage two, three, four. Sometimes, rarely, some people enter at five. But what you'll see when people have that kind of a higher birth, we call it a higher birth, they still have to clean up the mess that's left over. Like you had a party and you wake up in the morning and you think, I'm never going to drink again. Oh,
like
my God.
Hangover, like in the Hangover movies.
The Hangover. You're like, like the Hangover movies. I love those movies. I'm never going to drink again.
This tiger.
Yeah, exactly. And you walk out in the room and there's a tiger in the room. You're like, how did that happen? So, you know, now you're not relating to the tiger anymore. And all you want to do is clean up the mess, you know. So you clean up your party mess from the night before. So many people can be born in higher stages, stage four, stage five, maybe even six. I don't know. But I haven't met one of those. But, you'll definitely realize that there's still some mess in the living room from the party, your previous lives or the party. So you may be, let's say 50% in stage five, and then you distribute the other 50% over the lower stages. So there's still some lower stage of hedonism of stage one going on or something like that. But it's important to realize, but that's a few people on the planet, not a lot. Most of us are going to be born in stage one activity, hedonism, desperately trying to preserve ourselves, our independence, survival mode, fear, you know, and then all the bravado reactions that occur from that, all the ways of ambition and accumulation and ego aggrandizement that occur due to that stimulation. But anyway, so a lot of us will start in stage one and have to work through it. Some are born at higher stages. Now, what was my experience like in this process? My own personal experience, and this is the thing, when people listen to this, please do not compare. If I compare my spiritual experience to some of the masters I've had, mm-hmm. I would think I was the biggest spiritual dolt, which means like an idiot on the planet. I would think I'm unworthy. I have no right even opening my mouth about spiritual things. I don't even care that my teachers authorized me. I'm going to go to a cave for 5,000 lifetimes, because some of these gurus and lamas I was with had extraordinary lives, you know, extraordinary lives, born very high stage five when they were just born already. But me, little me, yeah, my little ego process started fairly young. You know, I was blessed with whatever reason that I had some minor curiosity. I don't want to use the word awakenings. I'm tired of the word. I had curiosities when I was young, and I wondered about life and death, and I wondered about God and so forth, that kind of thing. So when I was about four, my mother had a boyfriend who was a Cherokee Indian, and he taught me how to pray. And that really made me feel good, because I felt like I was connecting finally to God, you know. And I was a Catholic by religion, but, you know, it was a very distant, as a little boy, it was a very weird thing to think about some God in heaven somewhere, and I can't really connect to him. So I liked the fact that this Cherokee man taught me how to pray. And then when I turned seven, I had the wonderful fortune of connecting to yoga again, reconnecting from past lives. I was involved in yoga. Very, very wonderful reconnection with yoga, and really got into it. I would get up at 5 a.m. and do it every day. And that was lovely. So that was already, I was already developing or remembering and working with a practice from the past and using awareness with body movement and breath. So it's really hard to avoid some type of awareness development, right, when you're doing this. And that continued, and then it just continued constantly through those years. And I was kind of interested in religion and philosophy, so I read books on that. And then I would go and train with the priest at my local church. And then they said, you know, you're asking questions that are a little bit above our pay grade. So they sent me out to a priest that was about 15 miles from my house. And I started going there for private lessons. And then eventually at 15, I decided to go into pre-Catholic seminary training to become a priest. Because I thought, even though my yoga and meditation was going full on, and at 13 years old, I started deep into martial arts, which added another dimension because that teacher was teaching me how to meditate as well and how to do awareness training while you're alive and moving, you know, the martial arts, like all the awareness training that you do in martial arts and then the seated meditation. So all that was pushing me towards that. But I still felt like there must be some way to bridge the East and the West, right? And my family was Catholic, and I understood Catholicism a lot better by now because I'd had these private lessons for about 3 years by then. So I said, let me go pre-seminary and become a priest. And then I can change the church from inside. That was a crazy idea.
Dhamma?
Yeah. Did you say something?
Can you tell us about your tigers in the living room?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got off track. Okay. You want tigers. I see. You said, tell us about your personal developments. I'm just telling you the story of my personal training. So the tigers, what kind of tiger? Normal tigers like everybody else.
It's super interesting to and very relatable when you say, okay, that was my base point where I started and it changed so much
sure.
to where I am now. And
sure, you know? Sure. So I think the takeaway from all of it is that my tigers were the same as everybody else's, really. But what is it? So when I was young, I had no father, right? My stepfather and my mother divorced when I was 2. And it was a horrible environment from age 0 to 2. And I was the type of kid who had a memory from the first time I opened my eyeballs. I used to tell my mother, she didn't believe me. And I drew pictures of our whole apartment that we had when I was 1 year old, 2 year old. Mm-hmm. She couldn't believe it. And I told her what the house looked like that we were having in Kansas when I was 6 months old. It was kind of fun to play with her like that. But I did. I remembered all this stuff. Now, what I remember was how horrible he was. Mm-hmm. And I remember having a very not a nice experience of being in that house with so much emotional and physical violence and drinking going on. And when she divorced him, I had this huge sigh of relief. And I felt like now life is going to get good. And I feel like that was the type of awakening in a way. Mm-hmm. I was 2 years old. I was standing on top of the steps of our apartment in New York City. And my stepfather had his little suitcase and his hat on and his raincoat. I'll never forget it. And he said, okay, I'm leaving. Bye. And he gave me a kiss on the cheek. And I was like, good, get out of here. I couldn't wait. And he left. And I felt like that was a big opening, you know. Mm-hmm. But then it left me with this, who am I if mm-hmm. I don't have a father? So my mother moved. We moved into a countryside place with farms and Amish people in Pennsylvania. And I was like, well, who am I and what am I and what is the meaning of life? It really threw me at a pretty young age into it. But, you know, I wasn't sitting around pondering it all day like Ramakrishna or Ramana Maharishi. I was a kid. I was still a kid. So I was playing, having fun, that kind of stuff. But the fears kept coming. And I started to become afraid of death. So that was a big karmic tiger for me. Mm-hmm. I remembered, I don't know what triggered it. Honestly, I don't really remember any one incident, like seeing a dead person or when you grow up Catholic, you're always going to what are called wakes. So someone dies and you go, in English, it's called a wake. I don't know why, but you go there, maybe because you're awake in heaven or something, but you go and you see the person's dead body laying there on a table or in a coffin, and then you actually kiss it. So it's not like I didn't know what death was. That's one thing great about Catholicism is that you actually have to see death. In the Protestant religions, you know, you die and they whisk you away and you never see the body again. So we had to deal with death. So maybe that's what brought it on. But I had a tremendous fear of death. And I'm pretty sure a lot of listeners can relate to this. It's one of the common themes I hear from students who contact me that they also found they're afraid of death. Now, what is a karmic tiger? I mean, it really dictated a lot of how I did life. It caused a lot of fear. Mm-hmm. You're going to say?
Yeah. No, I didn't say something. I was just listening.
Okay. So that was a real big karmic tiger. And that drove me, I would say that drove me my whole life in spiritual work. I would say that was the number one driver. If you had it, like, what was your number one motive in spiritual work before any kind of deep realization started happening from your training? I would say it was fear of death. I was shit scared. What happens when we die? I have no idea. If it's the devil and going to hell, well, I'm definitely going to hell because I'm not a perfect person. You know, I have sexual thoughts. I steal stuff once in a while. I lie. I break all the Ten Commandments. I'm going to hell, you know? So I was really scared about that. And that drove me into doing the spiritual work and wanting to find out the truth. Is there really a God? Is there really a devil, Satan? Are there the Ten Commandments? Do they matter? Is there something else? So that drove me, that curiosity. The challenges I had then, I would say, yeah, we're about finding who I am and becoming authentic. So I'd say the next big karmic tiger I had was really being authentic. There was something driving me to attain the approval and authorization of somebody in a place of power, you know? So many of us, I think, can relate to that. We go to university to get a degree, to say, this is who I am. I did something great, you know, or we started a great business or something. But in my case, it was I wanted mentors. I wanted some kind of acknowledgement from something that pre-existed. For some reason, this was what I wanted. This was a hang-up of mine, you know. So I think that was fed strongly when I had my first real teacher when I turned 12. And at 7, when I was doing yoga, this yoga I was doing was, I was doing it with a guy on TV at 5 a.m. And I would do it on TV with him until I was about, God, I would think I did it for about 3 years. And then I had all his books at 7, 8, and 9. I was reading all his books. So that, but that wasn't a teacher I could ask questions to, right? But I was like a full-on yogin. I could do every posture and I was meditating, pranayama, bandhas, everything. And then I met a teacher in the flesh. And that's when things really started to change. And I started to look to him like, wow, okay, you're giving me knowledge and experience and you're giving me a set path to follow and telling me I've achieved these stages. So still my anxiety and my insecurity was starting to be alleviated through that. So that was one of my karmic tigers because I felt vulnerable and weak and inauthentic. And I wanted to get it from the outside, but that shifted luckily over the path to where you realize, oh, you have to get it from inside. And then your teacher acknowledges it. You know, that's the long journey that you realize. What was another karmic tiger? Oh, just karmic tigers of, I got up to a lot of bad stuff when I was a kid. You know, it was a really strange thing. Usually in schools in America, the kids who are in the top sections, which means they separate the kids with the high IQs, put them in these sections, and they all stay in a group together during their whole 12 years of school before university. And usually those kids are never doing any crimes or bad things. And of course, I was the exception to the rule. I was in the top section of the school. I had a very high IQ test on the test that they gave, you know, sick, like disgustingly high. So I'm not going to tell it. And yet I was doing bad things. I would go out. I was a young boy still, and I would sneak out of my window at night. And I had this amazing yogic body. So I would climb down the brick wall of my house. You know, there was no pipe for the water to go down you see in the movie. I was clinging to the bricks with my fingertips, you know, doing early rock climbing, I guess. So I would sneak out and I would run around my town and get up to all kinds of trouble on my bicycle in the middle of the night. I mean, I robbed a house one time. I'm ashamed to admit, but it's true. Robbed a house. And it was so fun that I went back to the same house 3 times the same night. You know, this is crazy stuff, but this is sort of what happens in inner city America. You know, I ran with a tough crowd and we were kind of crazy. So we did these crazy things, you know. And then when I got to be old enough to sneak out and take my mother's keys or my stepfather's keys to the trucks that we had because it was a construction company, I would go out and I'd sneak out and I'd get in the car, get in the truck, and I'd drive it all over the place for like 4 hours, climb back in the window at 3 a.m. and go to sleep. And no one would catch me. So yeah, I had these. So I was doing bad things like this. Those are like bad things I think kids shouldn't do. So I had these karmic tigers. Yeah, that's another karmic tiger.
And how would you say how it changed during the years when you see at yourself now as a person?
Well, you to think about it,
some like a flavor of comic tigers in some actions, or
good point. So, do the tigers actually disappear, these karmic tigers, or do they get weaker and become kitty cats, and you have to watch them because they might still scratch
you? That's a nice picture.
But yeah, but they can't kill you now, but they're a kitty cat, you know. Or do they stay as tigers, and you didn't really deal with them, and they can still kill you at any moment? Both possibilities exist. You know? Like, I was very afraid because I grew up in a really tough neighborhood. I saw people killed in front of me on the streets, and we had fights and things. And I was very, you know, afraid. So I got into martial arts and stuff. But a bully on the end of my block, who was 3 years older than me, he really scared me. He had my number psychologically, karmically, you know. Mm-hmm. And I found in that experience of that bully is how I found a way to deal with all of my karmas for the rest of my life. I would say there was two karmic tiger things that changed my life. Mm-hmm. Just making me think about this, Sandra. I haven't thought about this stuff for decades. The first one was, in my martial arts training, there was a technique I couldn't do. I was just not coordinated enough to do it. And every time I would do it, I would fall down. And I remember feeling very embarrassed. And I was part of a very small school, only 12 students. The door was closed. There was no sign outside. Once this teacher found 12 students, he closed the door and he only taught us. So it was very traditional. And here I was trying to hold up the best. I was the youngest kid in the school. Most of the others were adults. I was 12. And I would spin around, try to throw this kick, and I would fall down. I didn't have that coordination. And I cried. And he was like, get off the floor if you're going to cry. And I had to get out of the dojo. So then I would go home and I would go in my basement every day after school and practice and try to do this technique. And I would cry because I couldn't do it. And something happened where I had to face myself. I had to face myself very strongly and say, you're either going to collapse now and never be able to do this, or you're going to man up and say, if it takes me 20 years and the ridicule of 1,000 people, I'm still going to do it. I'm going to make it. And that was a changing point. I found my true heart when I was 12 in that moment. And I pushed through in a way that I had not known before. And I did suck at that technique for like another month. But eventually, with this dogged determination, I turned it around until when I was going in my amateur kickboxing fights, I was knocking people out right and left with this kick. So it became something. That was a big turning point for me. Now, that karmic tiger for me really doesn't exist much anymore. To be quite honest, that one is a putty cat on a chain that I have now with me that supports me. I never fail when it comes to anymore, when it comes to needing to do the strong thing. You know, that one I have. Mm-hmm. But we all have different things. So then I'll tell you another big karmic tiger I had as a kid just occurred to me. Really bad one. I was probably 13 or 14. And I was around, maybe 12, around that same time. A lot of growth in that time, astrological window I had. I came home from school. I didn't have a plan to go hang out with any of my friends. Nobody was around. And I was panicking. I found like a panic inside of me. I didn't know what it meant at the time, but now I would know I was panicking. And I was like, why am I panicking inside? What's happening? I was like, well, I just want to play with one of my friends. So I looked out down the block. Nobody was around. I got on the phone. I called a few people. In those days, phones were on the wall. I had a cord. So I called from the phone on the wall. Nobody was around. And I was like panicked. And sunset started to happen. It was the winter and the sun was low. And the sun was coming down quickly. And I was like, oh my God, what's happening? And it got darker and darker. And I thought, oh my goodness. And I had a real panic. And the beautiful thing was, out of that panic, I sat down and said, I'm going to face this fear. Just like the kick, just like the bully. The bully story I never told you. I ended up facing that bully. And I said, you're going to beat the crap out of me and I don't care. I stood right in front of him. I said, you're going to make me hurt. You're going to break my nose. You're going to make me bleed. I don't care. I'm going to fight you anyway until I'm unconscious. Let's go. And the kid was so turned off by the whole thing that I wasn't afraid anymore that he left me alone. And I learned from that and from the kicking experience that I just have to push through every fear I've got to face fully, because the freedom only comes when you fully face your fear, and that karmic tiger becomes your pretty cat, right?
Right.
So I sat down in that moment. I'll never forget this. In my living room, I sat down, hung the phone up, couldn't find my friends to play with. And I said, why am I so afraid right now? Because I was terrified. Sandra, I was terrified. why am I so afraid? Nothing bad is happening to me. I don't understand this, this psychological, spiritual feeling. And I sat and closed my eyes and I meditated. I contemplated deep down into the source of it. And I probably touched the anavamala, or that root sense of separation from the universe, for the first time on a deep level, because it hit me then. You are freaking out because you're afraid to be alone. You're afraid to be lonely. In other words, and I touched it, you're alone and you're lonely all the time. You're actually lonely all the time. You're actually freaked out that you're lonely all the time. And it hit me. But even though I ran around as a young boy with lots of fun and friends, underneath it all, I was a complete fraud. I was lonely. I was scared. I was totally afraid of being alone. And I was alone. I really realized the truth of the teaching that no one really gets you. You are alone. So that was my karmic tiger. That and the fear of death were very much linked, you see. Mm-hmm. And they remained. Then you want to know how it lasted with me. That remained all the way through my path until, I could say very recently, until 2005, I'd say. I really had that strong sense of loneliness still. But I said, I'm going to just keep going. I'm already an acharya, you know. And then I met another acharya. This was really an amazing thing. And we were sitting down having tea one day. And he looked at me and he said, isn't it a lonely path? I looked at him and I said, did you just say lonely? And he said, yeah, because it was not considered okay to talk about being lonely. You're supposed to be beyond loneliness, right? Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be beyond wanting a mate, a partner, or friends. And I looked at him with amazement and tears came to my eyes and I smiled and I said, yeah, it's really lonely. You feel it too? And he said, yeah, oh, sure. It's a lonely path. That's the way it is. It's part of the path. You just have to accept it. And at that point, that was the turning point, when I just completely accepted it and get, okay, no matter what happens with other people, I'm always going to be lonely in some sense, because this is the human realm and no one really gets each other. You know, you try really hard. That's why we have the mirror consort path in our tradition. Mm-hmm. You get with a consort, a male or a female, and you train together to try to have ultimate intimacy with each other as a reflection of ultimate intimacy of you and your own nature, of you and your own base. And that's why I think it's the greatest path there is, the mirror consorts. But this guy at that moment, this other acharya, and I sitting there having tea, he blew my mind. And I said, tell me what you mean. And he said, well, you know, we're alone. That's all there is to it. We're alone in this path. When you're an acharya, you don't really have friends. All you have is thousands of students. And all they do is, you know, want something from you all the time. You can't have real friends. And I was like, wow, it's true. You know, it's true. And so we don't get this type of nourishment that other people get all the time. Affection, friendship.
Why, you know, why is it like that? Why can't you have friends?
It's just too hard. Right, it's too hard, because if you're really serving every moment that you could be serving, you know, if you're playing with your friends, it's time that you really could be serving. So maybe you have Dharma friends. This is what I realized. I have Dharma friends. So we'll go and do a teaching or something, and then we'll have tea or dinner or a day or two at a beach after, and that's it for the next year or two. And that's about all you can do. Mm-hmm. If you're a teacher, and I'm not saying this is for normal people practicing the Dharma, they should have friends, lots of friends, and enjoy it, right? But it's a lonely path. The spiritual path in general is a lonely path, because you do it alone. You're born alone, you die alone. That's it. You know, when people run around saying, oh, I feel one with everything, and that's why I feel so much joy and love in my heart, I don't believe it. Personally, I don't believe that that's the path. I don't think you become one with everything. You know, I'm not going to become one with the chair I'm looking at in the room right now, or the tree I see outside. There's a sense of oneness in that we're all part of one game. But it's not a sense that I'm the chair, I'm the tree, I'm the ocean, I'm these other people. That type of realization, I think, is false, to be honest. I think you have to have your own immaculate realization of your own base, your own essence awareness. This is what our tradition teaches. And that's where the final resting place is. And that starts at stage 7, you see. And it's very full while you're still in a body. It's as full as it can be while you're still in a body at stages 10 and 11. But then it gets so full, the experience of your own base, that there's no reason for individual existence on that level anymore. And then your rainbow light body, see? But anyway, to get back to it, these tigers, yes, the loneliness tiger stayed with me up until about 2005. And the fear, the fear of vulnerability, fear of death, that remained, you know. And to be honest, we talk about fear of death. Is that ever really gone until stage 10 when you're immortal? No, I think it'll always be lingering. It just has a little different significance each stage, you know.
So you're still scared of death?
I imagine. Mm-hmm. I'm scared. You know, I'm scared. I think about this often. We were talking to my consort about this, Sukalia, the other day. And it's the last fears I have around dying are the fears of leaving my students unbaked, unfinished, mm-hmm. not finishing the final books I want to leave behind so people can help themselves with realization. So it's more about the fear of dying with unfinished business mm-hmm. than the fear of dying itself. Where, you know, I was younger, fear of dying itself scared me because I didn't know what was after death. Mm-hmm. Now I can pretty much confidently say, I don't know exactly what happens after death, even though our teachings say what happens, but I've been out of my, what's that?
You don't know exactly. No one knows.
Exactly. No one knows exactly until you're there how it's going to manifest, right? How it's going to manifest. We know the stages of death. We know what happens after death for sure in the tradition. And I know that's true because of what I've experienced while I'm still alive. But we don't know what content in the way that that content will present after death. We know the stages. We don't know which, here we go, tie it back into what you're asking. We don't know which karmic tigers will show up. And we don't know exactly how well we'll deal with them in the after-death states, mm-hmm. right, if we don't rainbow body. And that's what we want to know, which karmic tigers show up. We want to get them diminished to pussycats by the time we die. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there is this, one of my karmic tigers is still, can I finish these 10 books I need to finish before I die? Can I finish a few acharyas to leave behind this tradition after I go, as my teachers asked me to do? Those are still fears, and I have to work with those still.
Do you still feel lonely sometimes?
I think every now and then I do. I do. To be honest, every now and then I think, it's a lonely path. But, you know, it's a point where I accept it. There's a difference between I feel lonely and I'm going to resist it, and I'm going to go out and try to change it, get friends, or be happy, or have a drink, or paralyze my mind with meditation so I don't feel lonely, you know, the wrong use for spiritual practices, right? To anesthetize ourselves, to take away pain. So that's no longer there. When loneliness is there, I'm like, oh yeah, it's a lonely path. Oh yeah, you go alone. That's fine. You know, and relax into the base. And that's the difference. Once you're working at stage 7 or above, you're able to relax into the base experience no matter what kind of difficulty is in front of you, what kind of karmic tiger or what kind of situation arises in the moment. You're able to relax into your base, and it's a stage of the path. It's a nice fruit to experience because then you can basically get on with helping others because you're not so absorbed all the time with dealing with your own karmic tigers. You're like, okay, my karmic tigers are pussycats now, and I accept them fully, and now I can get on with just being there for others, you know?
Thank you so much for sharing this and for being so open. I think it helps a lot of people, and also to see how it is possible to change. I can relate so much because I can remember when I was super young, like 3 years, I was thinking, how would God like could look like? And I had a very clear picture about how God would look like, and he was very present for me. And I went to bed with her. I mean, I also had, of course, like teddy bears, but I also had a small statue of Maria in my bed. Nice. And I also was so drawn to religion, but because I was so scared of the evil and ghosts and stuff like that.
Right, right. And
so fucking scared that, sorry for fucking... I was so scared that I can remember so well one night I was, honestly, I was nearly shitting my pants because I was so scared. And I said, okay, I have to make a deal with the devil or with the evil. So I'm part of it and I don't have to be scared anymore.
Right, right. I think the last podcast.
I can't stand the fear anymore. No, that was when I was 8 or 9 or something like that.
Yeah, I think the last podcast we touched on that you and I share exactly the same experience. I was visited by all those spirits. And that's when I say fear of death, that was also part of it. Mm. I'm afraid when I die, all these spirits just come and take me away, you know? Yeah. So that's why we want to, as a yogin, the cool thing about a yoga, one thing that turned me on about the yoga tradition early on was my teacher said, I said, what's the purpose of yoga? He must have read my mind. And he said, the purpose of yoga is to die before you die. Mm-hmm. So that you know exactly the truth of the whole universe. And I was like, okay, mm-hmm. I'm in. That's all I got to hear, you know?
Yeah. So yeah. I am excited to study with you and to know the truth before to die while I'm living.
Yay, yes. Absolutely.
And absolutely. If persons are interested right now to study with you as well, where can they find you? And do you have some current offerings?
Yeah, they can go to the Trika Mahasiddha Yoga Facebook group at this point because our website is delayed as we're trying to hook up a payment gateway so that people can actually buy the courses we have on there, the trainings that we have on there. So that should be taken care of within a month, let's say. But until then, there's so much they can look at on the Facebook group, Trika Mahasiddha Yoga, and the YouTube channel has all the videos up for free. I think we have like 30 classes up there for free as well. That's a YouTube channel called Trika Mahasiddha Yoga. You know, Sandra, then I've been contacted a lot lately by Germans, lots and lots of German students.
Yeah, because I'm your spokesperson.
That's why, huh? Yeah, and they're now coming on Facebook friends and stuff. So I said, okay, I keep telling them, we're going to come and do a training as soon as COVID is over. Sandra's going to bring me and we'll do some nice training. Hang tight.
Perfect. I think this podcast is coming out in September. So probably the website is out there. And I personally can totally recommend to study with you and also the online courses preliminary.
Let's hope it is. If it is out by then, it'll be Trika Mahasiddha Yoga. That's the name of the website. But let's hope.
Perfect.
I'm always disappointed with this IT stuff. They always say, oh, a few more weeks. And it's like months. Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking your time.
And thank you, Sandra.
Looking forward for our next conversation. Thank you.
Yes, wonderful. So, talk soon.
Das war eine neue Folge von House of Grace. Ich hoffe, diese Episode hat dir gefallen. Und falls das der Fall gewesen ist, freue ich mich sehr, wenn du zum Beispiel auf Apple Podcasts eine Bewertung hinterlassen würdest. Und vielleicht hast du ja auch Lust, House of Grace zu folgen. Das kannst du zum Beispiel bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder Deezer tun. Mich persönlich, Sandra von Zaubjenski, findest du auf Instagram. Den Link dazu gibt es in den Shownotes. Und ich freue mich riesig über Feedback, Kommentare, Anregungen, auch per E-Mail an podcast@house-of-grace.de. Alles Liebe, eure Sandra.